The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, we're going to look at one of the last, greatest mysteries in science. It's a profound, yet intangible aspect of the human condition, and philosophers, thinkers, and scientists have struggled to understand it. That thing, so familiar to us all, yet so strange, is consciousness. On March the 7th, at the Royal Institution in London, I'll be bringing together a panel of experts to ask the question, can science ever explain consciousness? As a warm-up, we gathered the speakers to go through some of their key scientific and philosophical conundrums, and to give us their thoughts on how close we are to solving them. We brought together Professor Anil Seth. He's the co-director of the Sackler Centre for Consciousness Science at Sussex University. Professor Chris Frith is Professor Emeritus at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London. And Dr. Barry Smith is Director of the Institute of Philosophy at the School of Advanced Study at Birkbeck University. Until relatively recently, many of the most influential ideas about what consciousness is have been the preserve of philosophy. So I started our discussion by asking Barry Smith to do the impossible. I asked him if he could summarise a few thousand years of Western thought on the classification of consciousness.
Well, I think philosophers have been fascinated by this because they've wanted to know how we fit into the world of nature. People think of conscious beings who decide and act and choose what to do as rather special. And obviously we pay attention to human beings as a very special part of the world. Now, we fit into the world because we have bodies, but we don't just have bodies. We have bodies who feel a certain way and are aware of their limbs, can see, can taste, smell, think, experience emotions. And the question is, how does that more elusive stuff, which we can't see and we can't touch in other people, how does that fit into the world of nature?
In ancient times, was it seen as something special, something inside you that sort of was a life force of some sort?
It could be seen as something inside you, but they weren't sure quite where. Sometimes it might be in the heart. It's only in more recent modern times that we've actually located it in the brain. But really, everyone was aware there was something very special about having a mind, and in particular having a rational mind for the Aristotelian philosophers. And the question is, when we've got this mental life, this subjective way of experiencing the world, feeling things, how do these facts of mental life fit into the world of facts as described by the natural sciences? That's been the challenge. And of course, a famous philosophical answer is they can't. So René Descartes in the 17th century thought there had to be something over and above the realm of facts described by the natural sciences. There had to be not just a physical realm, but a mental realm. And the mental realm was immaterial. And it was somehow separate from a distinct kind of thing. Now, of course, that gave him huge problems in trying to say, how did the mental have any impact on the physical?
Where was it?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be somewhere if it's immaterial, because it's not extended in space, although it does have temporal dimensions. But how does it make things happen? How does it move your body? How does it make decide where to go and then go there with your physical limbs actually responding to those decisions and thoughts? And vice versa, how is it that when the body is damaged, something then in the immaterial world feels a certain way, feels pain?
And how closely tied are ideas of consciousness to ideas of the self, like how we perceive ourselves and experience the world?
I think it's very tied up with that. I mean, the way in which we all care about consciousness is because consciousness seems to be where we are, where we live. And people who have believed in an immaterial, conscious, mental realm have thought the self isn't actually any part material. You just have a body. That's something you happen to have. And of course, that gave rise to religious ideas about the self and consciousness existing after death and after the destruction of the body. So I think we're very bound up with the idea that consciousness is something that we are. That's where the self is. It inhabits those thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs, desires, hopes, fears.
And with that background, Anil, let's get on to the scientific study of consciousness. Why are scientists, or why have they been in recent decades, perhaps, until recent decades, so reluctant to study it?
I think it's important to recognize, actually, that the birth of psychology back in the 19th century, consciousness was actually at the heart of psychology. Then the first labs in psychology, William James and Wilhelm Wundt, focused on subjective experience as the main thing they wanted to understand. And it was ejected from the realm of legitimate study by behaviorists in the early 20th century, mainly on the grounds that of the suspicion that you couldn't trust evidence coming from introspection, just our reports of our own experiences.
Because you'd be biased or whatever else.
Mainly because nobody was able to check them. It's relied on what you said, and this was thought to be relatively untrustworthy. And the behaviorist revolution went really quite far, and surprisingly from hindsight now, quite deep. And consciousness has returned to center stage, I think partly for a few different reasons. One is behaviorism itself has become less popular since the 60s, really, when its limitations became clear, that in fact you couldn't understand behavior purely in terms of just responses to external stimuli, and in fact trying to understand language was a big part of that. The second thing, I think, has been the advent of different kinds of technologies. So brain imaging in particular allows us actually to look inside the brain and see different activity patterns when people are experiencing different things. And this provides an invaluable different angle on trying to find objective evidence that's relevant to consciousness. It isn't just people's introspective reports, although of course you have to put the two together now. And so I think these things together have led to a realization that, yes, we can study consciousness. The third thing, I think, has to do with this so-called hard problem, or that started with Descartes, whether he discovered it or invented it, we don't know. But another, a suspicion has been that you can't really study consciousness because of this big mystery about how something material might generate experience. But of course, we can just pragmatically recognize that consciousness is part of the universe in which we live, describe its properties, and go about studying them scientifically.
You mentioned there the philosopher David Chalmers is termed the hard problem. Can you just define that just for listeners?
So there are actually a number of different ways to define the hard problem. One of them is the problem of, even if we knew everything about how the brain works, how all the neurons interact, how they transform sensory data into actions, how they generate memories, and even then we still would not understand why any of these physical operations should be accompanied by subjective experience. Why aren't we all just able to do this without experience at all? That's one version of the hard problem.
I mean, another way of putting it that Chalmers likes is, even if we had a full explanation of what made you move and produce these sounds you're producing now and have all the reactions you have, if it's possible to think that all of that could be going on, but there was nobody home, so to speak, that you were at like a zombie. You looked and moved and walked and behaved just like a human being like me, but you didn't have the conscious experience that I'm aware of in my own case and can't be sure of in yours. And Chalmers thinks that if it's possible that something could be physically just like me without being conscious, then that means that conscious property isn't explained by my physical properties.
Chris, how much do scientists need to define consciousness before then going on to then use it in whatever fashion they want to understand the mind, say?
Well, my view, which is sort of to some extent the opposite of philosophy, is that we study it first and then define it afterwards. And I think one of the big advances in the study of consciousness, which came from trying to link the brain and the mind, was the revelation of how much is actually unconscious. And the critical thing is to contrast conscious processing, whatever you like to call it, with unconscious processing. And this really starts with, at the end of the 19th century, the only way you could study the brain and the mind then was by looking at patients with lesions of one kind and another, usually due to strokes, but also due to bullet wounds, so that each large-scale conflict produced a great flowering of neuropsychology, strangely enough. And there are some striking cases here where you can find a patient with a relatively circumscribed lesion who, well, let me just give a concrete example, case of the famous patient DF. She is unable anymore to recognize objects from their shape. So she couldn't tell you what this is because she doesn't know what shape it is. But she can actually reach out and grasp it perfectly well. So the evidence about its shape is there in the brain and can control her arm movements and finger movements, but she's actually not aware of this. And this kind of work then goes into studying of healthy intact people. And using more clever experimental designs, you can again reveal how much it is that we do, which we're not actually conscious of.
And this is quite an important point, actually. A lot of the autonomous processes in the body we're not aware of, and we'd go crazy, mind the phrase, if we had to control everything consciously. Yes. So consciousness is just one part of what the brain constructs.
Yes. And I would think it's actually quite a small part.
A small but important part for this discussion. But Anil, what mechanisms are there now to try and find the seat of consciousness, if such a thing were to exist in the brain? What are we? How are we looking? And are we close to finding anything?
We're getting closer, I think. And certainly now it seems pretty clear that the sufficient neural mechanisms for consciousness, well, neural mechanisms, they lie in the brain. One doesn't really need anything else. And there have been some arguments about maybe the physical basis of consciousness could involve something other than the brain. But the fact that we can have experiences when we're dreaming without interacting with the world, I think belies that. And then within the brain, there's increasing evidence that can narrow it down to specific parts of the brain. So, for example, the cerebellum, the bit at the back of the brain, which is involved in controlling movements mainly, but also lots of other things too, and actually has more than 50% of all the neurons that we have in our heads, doesn't seem to be much involved in consciousness. You can have quite extensive damage to it, and your basic facts of your subjective experience won't change. So these days, people really try to look at two different things. What's necessary for being conscious at all, say the difference between being asleep and awake or in a coma or anesthesia, something like that, and what's necessary for specific conscious contents. So, for example, the experience of an object or the smell of a rose, something like that. And we now think that it's a network of regions in the cortex, which is the crinkled surface of the brain, and the thalamus, which is deep within, that together provide both level and content. And if you have damage to particular parts of the cortex, you may lose the ability to have specific kinds of conscious experience, but you won't lose the ability to be conscious itself.
And Chris, this touches on this other issue that actually, if you look at patients with comas, or you mentioned earlier people with damage to parts of their brain, their consciousness is it qualitatively different? Are there different levels? I mean, how do you start to divvy these things up?
Well, this follows on from what Anil was just saying. So if there are some aspects of this where the conscious experience after brain damage will essentially be the same, but there's a bit missing. So, for example, there's the case so-called achromatopsia, where your vision of the world is completely normal, except you don't see colour anymore. And the result suggests that there's a relatively small part of the brain which is necessary for seeing colour, but it's not sufficient for seeing colour, and I think it's a sufficient bit that we don't really understand. But then the other side of it is where, due to coma or more extensive brain damage, you can actually have a more general change in the experience of consciousness. And there's the old days psychiatrists used to talk about clouding of consciousness, which means everything becomes slightly deficient, and this would be associated with things like Alzheimer's disease and so on.
So actually, I want to go down that line a bit further. Your own work is looking at sort of biomarkers for different, I want to say, psychiatric and other neurodegenerative diseases. Tell us what the study of consciousness helps with in that respect.
Yes, I was going to say that most of our work, I suspect, on patients is actually telling us about the nature of consciousness and its instantiation in the brain than it is for helping the patients. But the one area where I think there is genuinely relevant to the help of the patients is the study of people with locked-in syndrome, for example. So you have a person in a coma, and the question is, are they conscious but are entirely unable to move in any part of their body, so that you can never discover whether they're conscious or not? And this is where you have the idea that you might be able to find a biomarker that you could scan their brains somehow or another, and there would be a sign of whether they were conscious or not. This has proved quite difficult. So, for example, you can show that they must be understanding the meaning of words, but we no longer believe that that's a sign that they're actually conscious.
You can understand words without being conscious?
Yes, because we know in the normal case that you can present words in such a way that people clearly understand them but are not aware that they have been presented. But the interesting, from my point of view, which is, touches on the idea which we might get back to about the purpose of consciousness, is that where things seem to be moving ahead in deciding whether someone in a coma is conscious or not is when you give them the opportunity to interact with you. So you say, okay, this person can no longer move his hands, he can no longer speak, he can no longer even blink his eye, which has sometimes been used as a method, but he can still control his brain activity. So in this case, you're actually asking, I want you to imagine playing tennis or something, and then they, if they do that, you get a characteristic pattern in the brain. And once you've established this relationship so that they can at will produce certain patterns of activity in their brain, then you've got a communication system set up effectively. So you can say, right, if the answer is yes, imagine playing tennis. If the answer is no, imagine walking through your house.
And actually, this experiment is quite a famous one. It was published by Adrian Owen, formerly of University of Cambridge.
That's right. Adrian Owen and Melanie Bolley did this in around the 2005, 2006. And it was really very convincing, the first real evidence that, very difficult to refute, that these people had some residual awareness. And interestingly, it was actually not just locked-in patients, but there's another class of patients in the vegetative state. So after severe brain damage, you can be in a coma, but then you might recover, die, or go into this vegetative state, where it's the puzzling fact about that is you go through sleep and wake cycles, but there doesn't seem to be anybody home. And even in these patients, a small percentage of them were able to do this task. So when asked to imagine playing tennis or when asked to imagine walking around the house, would show these specific task-dependent activity patterns, not just responses to words, not just responses to language, but the sorts of things that you would get if you or I actively imagined doing these things.
What really matters about that wonderful experiment by Adrian Owen is that he's asking the patients questions that he knows the answer to. So their family members will give information about the name of the pet dog or whether they've been to Germany before. And getting the answer yes by imagining playing tennis, the answer no by imagining walking through your house, you can find out whether the answers are correct. Now that's, I think, the really convincing thing that makes you think this person is communicating with you. They understand the question and they're, as Chris says, voluntarily deciding to answer. The question is whether that consciousness that they have in answering is anything like the consciousness we have.
And they won't be able to tell you.
They won't be able to tell you. In fact, I asked Adrian Owen, why don't you ask them if they're conscious? And he said, they'll think I'm crazy. But I don't think they would. I mean, the suggestion I think that Adrian Owen has and others have is that when they're answering these yes or no questions, they're rather simple. It's a little bit like perhaps being in a hypnotic state. Is your name Mary? Yes. It's not like the full flourishing of consciousness that we might have. And I think this brings us on to something very important, namely that philosophers who ask, what is the physical basis of consciousness, are asking it as if there was one thing we meant by consciousness. But from what Chris has said and Anil has said, there's been a two-way flow between philosophers, neuroscientists and psychologists saying, well, consciousness isn't a single thing. There are different levels of consciousness. There are different things that consciousness might do and different ways it presents. You can be aware of things in consciousness or just conscious. So once you break it down, you see that there is no single hard problem. In fact, there are many problems. And that's where I think we're beginning to make progress.
Well, this brings me on to a specific question I had for you, actually, Barry, which is that the philosophical, we talked earlier about the philosophical underpinnings of this, these ideas and these thoughts. How has the science in the last couple of decades changed what philosophers think about consciousness?
Well, philosophers have a feeling that from the armchair, you know, just by thinking hard, they'll come up with these conceptual truths or necessary truths. And it's been something of an embarrassment to see that things we thought were just impossible are not only possible, but we've got patients of the sort Chris is looking at who do the things that we thought couldn't be done. An example, Wittgenstein said, nobody could have an experience of pain and wonder whose pain it was. To experience pain is to know it's your pain because you can't feel anyone else's pain. Now, of course, there are people with right parietal damage who have this syndrome called alien hand. So they think that their arm doesn't belong to them. Now, they might have feeling in the arm or in the hand, and you might even be able to prick that hand with a pin and say, is there a pain? Yes. Is it your pain? No. Whose pain is it? I don't know. Or maybe it's yours, the doctor's. So somebody is now doing something which Wittgenstein said was impossible even to think about doing. Now, that's a way in which it's changed the landscape to just see how consciousness breaks down into many subparts, and all those parts have to come together as an ensemble to give us what's so familiar and what we think is inevitable.
I know, Chris, I mean, you're hearing the sort of the humbling of philosophers a little bit there. How do you interact with that boundary? Or do you not think about it at all? Do you just think, well, I'm going to measure, I'm going to do experiments, and then it doesn't matter what the philosophical framework of this is?
No, I'm not at all. I did one of the sorts of studies that Barry was talking about in relation to schizophrenia, because I think this goes right back to Descartes, where he says, the one thing I can be certain about is that this is my thought. Yes. But schizophrenic patients have something called thought insertion, where they say, this thought I'm having is not mine. And I wrote about this, and philosophers were extremely interested, and I have had extremely fruitful discussions with philosophers, and interesting distinctions about, which I probably can't remember the term anymore, that you can say it's, in the case of the alien hand, you can, it's my hand, but I'm not the agent, or it's not even my hand. Yes. So there are all these things that I hadn't thought about until having discussions with philosophers. So this has been a very useful two-way interaction.
I think another example of that in some of my work, I've had lots of discussions with the philosopher Thomas Metzinger, who wrote a very long but very important book, Being No One, where he really analysed the concept of self. And this comes back to the question of definition of consciousness. We think we know what the self is intuitively, and a lot of it would be very easy as a scientist to take that intuitive conception of selfhood and then run around looking for its neural correlates in some sense or another. But actually, by engaging with the philosophical literature on selfhood, you can begin to understand that it's a much more ramified and complex concept involving things like the way, the first-person perspective I have on the world, which is not the same thing as being the same person over time. And then there's the physiologically embodied self. It's the ownership of my own body and perhaps of my own actions and thoughts as well. And so these things come together under the broad label of selfhood. But by coupling a philosophical analysis of the concept to experiments, you can begin to make a lot of progress. And for example, we can now induce things like out-of-body experiences in laboratories, which manipulate some but not all aspects of selfhood, and try to account for the mechanisms involved in those.
I mean, Anil, your centre at the University of Sussex specifically set up to study consciousness from as many scientific angles as possible. I mean, how are you tackling this? I mean, this interaction is clearly important between philosophers, scientists, different types of scientists. I mean, what is the team that's going to solve this, and how far are we?
Well, we're very fortunate, I think, in Sussex to have a very wide range of expertise. So on the one hand, I guess at one extreme, we start with physicists and mathematicians, because a big question is not just localizing brain regions involved, but actually finding out how you analyze all this deluge of data that we're getting from neuroimaging, and also how you might begin to construct theories that begin to account for properties of experience as well. And then you need quite a lot of mathematical and physical science insight. I hasten to say this does not mean that we have to look to strange or new or perplexing kinds of physics like quantum mechanics or anything like that. At the moment, there's absolutely no reason to look beyond classical physics and the methods of classical physics to understand neuroscience.
So you're dismissing the sort of quantum, you know, teleportation ideas. And
well, I wouldn't. You can't dismiss the possibility, because quantum theory is a very good explanation of the world, and any explanation we have has to be consistent with it. But what I'm reluctant to buy into is the idea that we must already appeal to some phenomenon that's specifically quantum in order to make progress. The suspicion usually comes about that, well, consciousness is very mysterious and quantum theory is very mysterious, so they must be related somehow.
Yeah.
But I'm suspicious of that connection. So then we can go up to coupling the physical and mathematical work to cognitive neuroscience and neuroimaging, where we will do experiments and record from the brain. And then I think at the higher level still, what's lacking is a real understanding of what subjective experience is like. So what is it like for somebody to taste a very good wine? What is it like for somebody to feel the urge to make a movement? And here again, we can connect with philosophy a bit for a better understanding of, if you like, the explanatory targets of consciousness science, and ultimately connecting it to work in the clinic. So we have a collaboration with the medical school there.
And also, I think that's absolutely right. It's trying to get a picture of what experience is like. And we've had really rather poor understanding of our own experience because it's so familiar, it's so upfront and in our face that we think it must be the way it appears to us. But very likely, we've got a faulty view of it. And Chris's work, I think, has really started to bring that out, to show us that we live in a rather vain conception of our experience being just as it appears, all in front of us, very easily accessible, and it's probably not like that at all.
Chris, how rich is our world? Is it possible to even describe what consciousness is doing in terms of integrating information and how much it's keeping away from us?
No, it's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, Thomas Metzinger, who Anil mentioned, who's very interested in the experience of moving and doing things, describes our consciousness of action as thin and evasive, which is a nice terminology, which means actually we have very little access to what we're actually doing, but we think we do. And I think that's true in all aspects of consciousness. So in some sense, the brain keeps from us most of the time what's going on. We don't even get it on a need-to-know basis, as they call it. There are recent experiments on choice blindness, for example, which is where people were approached in a supermarket and they were given two kinds of jam to taste. And then they gave it back, and then the person said, right, I'm going to give you the same jam again, and I want you to tell me what it was about it that made you prefer it. And on the proportion, I can't remember, 20% of the trials, using sleight of hand, they gave them the other jam back. And most of the time, people proceeded to explain to them why they had liked this jam better than the other. In other words, they seemed to have very little access to the choice they had actually made or the experience they had actually had. And I'm very interested in the idea that most of the time, the importance of attending so much to what we are doing is not in order that we can experience it, but in order we can justify ourselves to other people after we've done it.
So there's an interesting philosophical question there that Chris is well aware of, and that is, is it the case that we didn't actually have the information that we just thought we had about the jam and why we preferred it? Or is it that we had it and it was so fleeting and it was almost airbrushed out of consciousness immediately later, and that what we don't do is attend to it and retain it properly, or we get distracted when asked to justify it and tell us or tell the experimenter why we preferred one jam rather than another? And it's very difficult to get at that distinction, I think.
Though there's some clever new experiments from Patrick Haggard and others relating that precisely to making movements, where a lot of our experience of the action we have made, they suggest, is Orwellian. That is to say, we rewrite history after it's happened, and our experience is the rewritten version, not what actually happened.
Well, this is clearly the case in recalling memories from a long time ago. Every time you remember something, it changes slightly, and you remember the memory rather than the original event, I suppose. It raises the other question. What is the purpose, then, of this integrated consciousness that our brains produce? Is it to distract us while it gets on with running your body? Does anyone want to tackle that?
Well, I have some. I think that actually we have this strange idea that consciousness is private. It's something we can't share with other people. But I would say this is completely wrong. The purpose of consciousness is precisely so that we can share things with other people. And almost by definition, we can't share unconscious things with other people, so this is what's left. And I think it goes back to the original derivation of the word consciousness, which was knowledge that you share, common knowledge, co-science.
I think I take a slightly different view. It's nice to trace it back to the origin of the word, but I think there's definitely a role in conscious experience in interacting with other people in this social dimension. But another view on what the function of consciousness might be is to think what any given experience is like for us. So when you're having this experience of me talking now, it's ruling out an enormous number of alternative possible experiences that you might be having, because it's not just the sound of my voice that's bound together with the temperature of the room, the feeling of the chair on your back. All this is a unified conscious scene, which is extremely informative because it's ruling out all the other things that could have happened, might happen in the future, but aren't happening. And that can be very useful for an organism in guiding its behaviours. Now, part of what makes this experience different is, of course, the social dimension of talking to me and Chris and Barry, but it's the informativeness of the experience, I think, that's the true function of consciousness, or at least a possible one.
I would entirely agree that it's very important to have a mechanism that puts everything together and cuts out the ambiguities, but I don't see why it has to be conscious.
I mean, I think you get a rich picture, probably, of the sort Anil is alluding to there. But of course, lots of the studies in neuroscience recently have shown us that that picture isn't as rich as we think it is, and that we have an impression of having everything coming together, and perhaps it doesn't come together in quite the way we think it does. I think one thing you could think was the function of consciousness is not merely to be a kind of downwind consequence of everything going on. It's not just, as philosophers say, epiphenomenal. It's not something that just happens like steam rising from a cup of tea there after the fact for you to enjoy and reflect on what's already happened. It could be that it's a bit of a prime mover to actually urge you to do things, because when you see people with conditions like blind sight who in some part of their visual field, they can still reach for objects, but they have to be encouraged to do it, whereas the conscious subject reaches by themselves. And also, consciousness, remember, is that important thing, I think, which in the neurodegenerative patients or in the patients in vegetative state is the thing that makes them decide to imagine playing tennis.
Do any of you think that ever that replicating consciousness in a machine or some other way is a route to trying to understand it? And I mean, is it even possible to do that? Do we think of it as very human?
I mean, I think as a neuroscientist, you would have to say, if we're trying to work out the neural mechanisms from which consciousness emerges, and the real test of whether we have successfully done that is if we can make them in some other form, I mean, in silicon or whatever. And the interesting question there is, how would you know whether your robot was conscious or not? And I would say that's where the communication comes in.
My background is in artificial intelligence, and the same debate played out in that field as well about whether one could build a system that was actually intelligent, a strong AI view, or it was something that was merely a model of intelligence, the weak AI view. And now in people, there are a few people now trying to build machines according to their theory of consciousness, their machine consciousness or artificial consciousness, and the same question comes up. Are we to treat them as instantiations of consciousness or merely as simulations? And my view is probably as simulations, for the reason that if we build a large computer simulation of the weather, say of a hurricane, we don't expect it to actually be windy or wet as a result of that. Now, why should we expect a simulation of the brain to actually be conscious? There's one view that says yes, and that would be the view that consciousness is purely a function of the functional relations between its parts. It doesn't depend at all on the stuff that it's made out of. But I'm not confident that we can rely on that yet.
But Barry, if you can replicate consciousness in a machine, does that machine sort of have rights after a while?
Oh, it does, if you can replicate it. But I'm very doubtful you can replicate it. I really think that if we got a machine to walk and talk and behave just like us and communicate in the way Chris is talking about, it would be another sign of how consciousness was dethroned. It would be another sign of how well unconscious mechanisms could take over the tasks intelligently that we know that we can do a lot of the time without thinking about them. I mean, it's a strange thing to want to do. I mean, suppose I'm interested in jelly and why it looks and tastes the way it does and why it wobbles, and then I get a molecular chemical theory of jelly, and you say to me, yeah, but that theory is only any good if you tell me how something else could do that. It's not a theory of jelly. I still want consciousness explained.
I suppose it's about abstraction, isn't it? I mean, my final question is one which you may or may not want to answer completely, but is this something that will be tractable by science?
I think yes. I don't see why not, in the sense that that consciousness is part of the natural world. So far, things in the natural world have been more or less tractable to explanation by natural laws, even if we don't know all the details yet. There is the mystery still of why consciousness exists in the universe, but there's still the mystery of why the universe exists and why it contains a whole bunch of other things that we don't know why it contains. So it depends what people will take as a satisfying explanation. And I think that if we can account for all the sorts of features of what it's like to be conscious, then the big mystery of why consciousness exists at all will seem less pressing, and we may reach a level where we feel we do understand it.
I think, I mean, it's a bit similar to the explanation of life, which used to be, I think in the 19th century, was considered to be the hard problem. And interesting, at that stage, life and consciousness went completely together, and they're now separated out. So we more or less think we can understand life, and consciousness is something different. I think that we will certainly explain certain aspects of consciousness in the next several years. And part of the way that you do that, of course, is you redefine what you mean by consciousness so that you can explain it.
I think that's probably the problem for philosophers, the idea that maybe you'll get an answer by changing the question. But we still want to ask what consciousness is and what makes a physical thing like ourselves capable of having conscious experiential states. Maybe we'll never answer that. I mean, I do wonder whether we will. More important is to find out why does consciousness and conscious experience take on the form and character it does, and what has to be going on in the brain to give it that form and character, and what will happen to consciousness when the brain changes. If we have all those explanations, then I think Anil's put his finger on it. The thing then to press is, what would satisfy you as an explanation? And maybe nothing would satisfy you, because we want to find it puzzling and mysterious. And of course, if we explain it, it's no longer the puzzling and mysterious thing we're after.
It's a bit like the five-year-old who just says why to the end of every question.
Until the dialectical slap comes in. But I do think you shouldn't ask questions in philosophy unless you know what would count as a good answer to them. And I think at the moment, the question of what is consciousness or how is consciousness possible is so badly framed because we still don't know what would constitute a good answer or even who should answer that question.
Thanks there to Barry Smith, Anil Seth and Chris Frith. That is all, of course, just a taster to the panel discussion that will be held at the Royal Institution in London on March the 7th. For more information on how to get tickets for that event, and for more information on other events I'll be curating at the Royal Institution, you can click on the links in our blog, or you can go direct to the website www.rigb.org. One of those events, by the way, is a live recording of this podcast in the historic Faraday Lecture Theatre. We'll have more details for you in the coming weeks, but mark your calendars for March the 28th. Tickets will be free, but you'll need to register via the Royal Institution's website. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.